Hi guys, just to let you know, I have a promo of another podcast that I would love for you to listen to playing at the end of this episode, so please stay tuned until then. Warning: this episode contains description that some listeners may find distressing, so listener discretion is strongly advised.
In Leeds, Jim Hobson's new team of policemen has now taken over the Ripper inquiry. And already they claim to have had a pile of new information from the public. But they warn women who've been going out armed with knives and sharpened steel combs that they do risk arrest for carrying offensive weapons.
The narrow back alleys around Bradford's university were sealed off tonight as police made a detailed search of the area. The body was found by a patrolling officer, well hidden behind a low stone wall at the back of a large terraced house in the city's Bedsit area. Police believe it may have lain unnoticed there since Saturday.
He is being questioned in relation to the Yorkshire Ripper murders. It is anticipated that he will appear before the court in Dewsbury tomorrow.
Hi, M&Ms. Welcome back to another episode of Murder and More. As always, I am your host, Kira. According to the Open Society Foundations, sex workers are, quote, adults who receive money or goods in exchange for consensual sexual services or erotic performances, either regularly or occasionally, end quote. The term sex worker is preferred over prostitute, as sex worker recognises that it is work. Prostitution has negative connotations and denotes criminal behaviour. People fall into sex work for a variety of reasons, but the main factor seems to be that they are fighting poverty, and sex work is the only option that will financially better their lives and enable them to keep a roof over their heads and feed themselves and their children. Another reason people fall into sex work is because it allows flexibility, and the pay is typically much better than other jobs. Some people simply use sex work as a way to explore their sexuality. Either way, sex workers are seen as an ideal target for predators, who prey on their victims believing that if they go missing, they will not be missed, and it may not even be noted for a while that that person is missing. This is why sex workers are often hunted by serial killers. Wilma McCann was the first body to be found in the Yorkshire Ripper case. However, whilst she was the first body, police had no idea that she was actually the Ripper's fourth victim. She was just the first to succumb to her injuries. She was walking home alone in a playing field in the early hours of the morning of the 30th of October 1975. She'd spent the previous evening in several different pubs and clubs around Leeds before staggering home to her four children, whom she'd said goodnight to and tucked up safely in bed just 6 hours earlier. Wilma was extremely intoxicated from her night of drinking and was thumbing for a lift home. This is when she crossed paths with the Yorkshire Ripper, who was driving through the dark streets of Leeds and offered her a lift home. The pair ended up in a playing field just 100 yards from Wilma's home when she was struck on the head with a hammer before being stabbed over 15 times in the abdomen, neck and chest. She was eventually left to die alone, cold and no doubt petrified. Wilma's body was discovered exactly where the Ripper had left her, on her back, with her trousers around her knees and her strawberry blonde hair matted with blood, discarded in the middle of the field like a piece of rubbish you absent-mindedly drop on the floor, at 7:40 a.m. that morning by a milkman and his younger brother. Wilma's son, Richard McCann, who was only 5 years old at the time, will forever be haunted by the memory of learning that his mother had been so brutally murdered.
This police officer sat us down, and I'll never forget those words. Your mum's been taken to heaven. You're not going to see her again. And as a five-year-old boy, yeah, I was devastated. We worked out over the next few weeks that she'd been attacked at the back of the house on that field.
An extensive inquiry was subsequently undertaken, which involved 150 police officers. Despite 11,000 interviews being undertaken, the police were never able to identify Wilma's killer, a result which left her surviving family with a lifetime's worth of pain and hurt. The nightmare for Wilma's family would only be increased when one of her daughters committed suicide in 2007 after years of suffering with depression and mental illness as a direct result of her mother's brutal and unsolved murder. The Ripper's second murder, but fifth attack, was Emily Jackson, a 42-year-old who had fallen into sex work as a result of financial struggle. Following Emily's murder, her friends and neighbours were shocked by the fact that she was a part-time sex worker, possibly because she was married to a local roofing contractor. On the evening of the 20th of January, 1976, Emily was picked up from outside the Gaiety pub on Roundhay Road and taken to a secluded area on an industrial estate about half a mile from the pub. Once there, the elusive Yorkshire Ripper hit her over the head with a hammer before proceeding to stab her 52 times in the neck, chest, and abdomen with a screwdriver. Before he left her there to die, alone and cold in the derelict buildings, tucked away in the Manor industrial estate, he stomped on her thigh, leaving a boot impression. Emily's body was discovered partially covered with a coat the following morning, with her legs apart and handbag lying nearby. Further boot impressions were later found by police in the mud near the crime scene, and they took casts of the boots in plaster of Paris, which would give police an idea as to the type and size of the shoe that left the marks. Police were able to establish that the print was made by a size 7 workman's boot, leading to speculation that the Yorkshire Ripper was a manual worker of some description. Emily's murder demonstrated an emerging modus operandi and began to solidify in police's mind that they had a serial killer on their hands that needed catching. Not only were the police beginning to wonder if this was the work of a serial killer, but the press were also linking the cases together, striking fear into the residents of Leeds and Yorkshire. Concerns and anxieties surrounding the possibility of a serial killer began to dwindle as the months went by and no more bodies turned up. However, all hopes were dashed a year later when Irene Richardson, a young mother of two, fell victim to the Ripper's heinous acts. Irene was homeless and had no money to her name, which is how she fell into the sex worker industry. On the cold, dark evening of the 5th of February 1977, Irene was hanging around just down the road from the Gaiety pub and was picked up by a man. The pair drove to Roundhay Park, and it would be here, in the middle of Soldiers Field, that the Ripper would bludgeon Irene with a hammer. This time, he took it one step further, and when Irene was deceased, he mutilated her corpse with a Stanley knife. Irene's lifeless body was discovered the following morning by a jogger, partially covered with a coat, and her intestines spilling out of the wounds on her abdomen. Not only was Irene's body mutilated, but the Ripper had also posed it to cause maximum damage and effect to the individual who would eventually end up finding her.
Whoever had done it put himself in the position of the first person coming round the corner, and almost like a film or television producer, you could imagine him framing his shot and saying, "No, that's not quite right, let's go and spread the legs a little bit more." And you could see the drag marks on the ground where the body had been rearranged at least twice, possibly three times, for maximum effect. There wasn't just arrangement of the body, there was arrangement of the possessions. The boots had been neatly arranged across the legs. The contents of the handbag had been neatly arranged to one side.
Whilst tyre tracks left at the scene produced numerous potential suspect cars and led police to speaking to over 30,000 people, a suspect was never identified in the brutal murder until many years later. Attacks and murders occurred in rather quick succession throughout the second half of 1977. On the 23rd of April, 32-year-old Patricia Atkinson had spent the evening drinking in different pubs before being picked up by the Ripper. Patricia, who liked to be called Tina, was a sex worker in Bradford and a mother of three. But this time, the unknown assailant deviated from his modus operandi, and instead of ambushing her in the street or in a dark park late at night, the Ripper took Tina back to her flat, where he raped and murdered her. When he left, Tina was still making gurgling noises, presumably clinging onto life by a thread. The Ripper threw a sheet over Tina's body, and that's where she remained until the following evening, when a friend made the gruesome discovery. Not only was the location of the murder different, but the manner in which Tina was killed demonstrated an obvious escalation in the Ripper's violence.
The head injuries were infinitely more severe. The skull underneath the skin was the classical bag of marbles skull, as it's called in pathology. When you touched it, you could feel that there were multiple fractures all over the place.
As with the scene of Emily Jackson's murder, a boot print was found on the bedsheet inside Tina's bedroom. Unsurprisingly, the prints from both crime scenes matched. The police were starting to become desperate. They knew they had a serial killer loose on the streets of Leeds and Yorkshire. 2,300 house inquiries were performed by police and over 2,000 statements were taken, but their efforts proved futile when they were still unable to identify their vicious attacker and murderer. In the early hours of the 26th of June 1977, Jane McDonald was just 16 years old when she was walking home after spending the evening with her friends in Leeds city centre. Jane had spent the evening with an 18-year-old boy named Mark Jones, and the pair had parted ways at about 1:30 a.m. Jane intended on calling a taxi, but when her phone call went unanswered, she decided to walk home instead. Jane's route home took her past where Emily Jackson was last seen, outside the Gaiety pub, her destination being on Scott Hall Avenue, just six houses down from where Wilma McCann lived. The Ripper spotted Jane walking alone at 2 a.m. and deemed her to be a sex worker, as she was in the red light district. He parked up and watched her for several minutes before climbing out of the car and discreetly following her. He then struck her on the back of the head and dragged her into a nearby playground, where he stabbed her several times in the chest. Her body was discovered in the playground, not far from her home, by two children, and the murder very quickly struck fear and panic throughout the north of England. Due to Jane's young age and apparent lack of links to sex work, the public began realising that this was a violent, disturbed individual who would murder anyone he crossed paths with, no matter how innocent they were. In the public's minds, they were all potential targets and victims. Following Jane's murder, Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield was assigned head of the inquiry and quickly realised that they had tons of information and thousands of statements related to the murders. Despite some mounting amounts of information, the Yorkshire Ripper still wouldn't be caught for another 4 years. 20-year-old Jean Jordan fell victim to the Yorkshire Ripper on the 1st of October 1977 while working as a sex worker in Manchester. It wouldn't be until 8 days later, on the 9th of October, when Jean's body was found by a local dairy worker turned actor, Bruce Jones, who played Les Battersby in Coronation Street until 2007. Bruce was searching for bricks for his allotment that adjoined the site where the body was found when he made the gruesome discovery. Flies that had laid eggs on Jean's body demonstrated that Jean had been moved approximately 3 days after she was murdered, presumably to expose her body and for maximum effect, just as he had done with Irene Richardson. Jean's handbag was discovered in a nearby garden, and in a secret compartment in the bag, police found a brand new £5 note which they speculated may have been given to her by the killer. This note was able to be traced to several branches of the Midland Bank in Shipley and Bigley, which then allowed police to narrow down their suspect list to the 8,000 employees who worked for 35 different firms which may have used the note in their pay packets. One of these firms was T&WH Clark, an engineering haulage company. Over 3 months, the police interviewed over 5,000 men who worked at these firms. One of these men was Peter Sutcliffe, who was a lorry driver for T&WH Clark, who informed the police that he spent the majority of the evening in question at a family party, an alibi that later proved credible. Peter Sutcliffe was born on the 2nd of June 1946 to working-class parents John Sutcliffe and Kathleen Francis in Bingley. Bingley is an urbanised market town in West Yorkshire, just on the edge of the Yorkshire Dales. It has a rich history, with the Leeds and Bradford Canal being finished in 1774, linking Bingley with nearby towns Skipton and Bradford. The canal traverses through Bingley's town centre and travels up through the valley via the Bingley Five Rise and Bingley Three Rise locks. The police believed that the £5 note produced no solid suspects. However, completely unbeknownst to them, they had already interviewed the Yorkshire Ripper, and he'd slipped out of their clutches and was able to continue his heinous killing spree. Sutcliffe was brought up as Catholic. However, even a strict religious upbringing would fail to stop the heinous character he turned out to be. Although saying this, Sutcliffe showed no signs of abnormality and portrayed no signals that he may go on to be anything other than a normal adult. His childhood was a typical one, and he remained seemingly normal right through to his early 20s. Sutcliffe left school when he was 15, where he's reported to have been a bit of a loner who didn't have many friends. After that, he got several menial jobs, including working as a gravedigger in the 60s, a job which is reported to have given him a dark sense of humour. Some reports suggest that Sutcliffe used sex workers' services in his late teens and early 20s, and that he may have had a bad experience with one, leading him to become the monster he became. However, other reports refute this claim and suggest there's no evidence he ever sought services from sex workers. Nonetheless, it was in the late 60s that Sutcliffe began demonstrating some unusual behaviours. Sutcliffe would later confess that he realised the £5 note he had given Jean for her sexual services may well be traceable, so after the house party, he returned to the wasteland found behind one of Manchester's cemeteries where he'd left her body in order to retrieve the note. However, when he returned to Jean's lifeless body, the note was no longer there, so instead, he mutilated her body and moved it. Frustratingly, even though the £5 note seemed like it was going to be an important lead, eventually it led police nowhere, and they were unable to identify who the note had been issued to. Despite being interviewed by police and Sutcliffe nearly being caught, he persisted with his attacks, with Marilyn Moore being attacked on the 14th of December. Marilyn was a 25-year-old sex worker from Leeds who was doing business in the red light district of Chapeltown. Sutcliffe picked Marilyn up and drove her about a mile and a half away from where he'd picked her up and told her his name was Dave. He parked up on some waste ground just 200 yards from where he'd murdered Wilma McCann 2 years earlier, where he suggested the pair get into the back seat. Sutcliffe walked round to the locked passenger side door to let Marilyn out, but as he opened the door, he attempted to strike her over the head with a hammer. However, just as he was attempting to do so, he lost his balance and didn't strike her as hard as he was meaning to. Marilyn fell to the floor, where she remembers being struck several more times before falling into unconsciousness. This wasn't a quiet attack. With Marilyn screaming and a dog barking somewhere nearby, Sutcliffe decided it was time to leave before being able to kill her. Luckily, she survived her attack and was able to provide police with a description of her attacker. Roughly 30 years old, standing at about 5'6" with a stocky build. She also described her attacker as having dark, wavy hair and a beard and a moustache. Moreover, police found tire tracks at the scene of the crime, which they were able to link to an earlier attack. Finally, it seemed like the police may be getting somewhere. They were at least able to link some of the attacks. However, identifying the attacker would prove a much more difficult feat to achieve. Marilyn Moore wasn't the first person to be attacked by Sutcliffe and survive, however, a fact which wouldn't reveal itself until many years later. The attacks, that would later go on to be confirmed as attacks committed by the Yorkshire Ripper, actually began on the 5th of July 1975 when 36-year-old Anna Rogalski was attacked while she was walking alone in Keighley in the early hours of the morning. Anna was quickly rendered unconscious after being struck with a hammer and was slashed in the stomach with a knife. Thankfully, after being found just under an hour after her attack, Anna underwent a 12-hour operation and managed to get away with her life, but only because Sutcliffe was disturbed by a neighbour and fled the scene. Despite her physical health being ultimately unaffected by the assault, her mental health wasn't extended the same luck, and, unsurprisingly, she was psychologically traumatised as a result. Anna passed away at the age of 75 in April 2008 of natural causes. Just the following month, 46-year-old Olive Smelt was attacked by Sutcliffe in Halifax. Olive had spent her Friday evening with friends, drinking in a pub in the town centre. This second attack would form the modus operandi for Sutcliffe's attacks, with Olive also being struck from behind and slashed with a knife just above her buttocks. As with Anna's attack, Sutcliffe was interrupted, this time by a passing car, and escaped the scene before he could murder Olive. Olive spent 10 days in Leeds Infirmary after undergoing brain surgery, but ultimately survived her attack, although she did suffer mental and emotional trauma as a result of her ordeal and was diagnosed with clinical depression following the attack, a hardly surprising diagnosis. Olive provided a description to the police of her attacker. He was roughly 30 years old, 5'10", slightly built, with dark hair and a beard. Olive passed away at the age of 82 in April 2011 after a bout of pneumonia. Tracy Brown was attacked by the Yorkshire Ripper on the 27th of August 1975. The 14-year-old was walking alone down a country lane when she was approached by a man. Quote, "He asked, 'Have you got a boyfriend?' And I told him I had and that he lived in Silsden. I felt quite comfortable with him because he seemed such an unassuming, charming sort of guy." End quote. The man walked with her until they were close to her house and she turned to thank him for his company on the dark, lonely streets.
"He just seemed very unassuming and I wasn't aware that I should fear, have any fear of this person. And I didn't feel that I was in a dangerous situation with him."
The man then struck her from behind before hitting her over the head a further 5 times.
"I just felt like a door thud. There was no pain. It was that hard. It was knocked me senseless. And it just felled me. And I was just on the ground and it was hitting me again. I didn't even panic, I just remember just saying, 'Oh, stop, please, just stop.'"
As with other attacks the Ripper had committed, a car passed by and the perpetrator threw her over a barbed wire fence and ran from the scene as soon as he saw the lights of the car. Quote, "My vision had gone because I was so stunned from the attack and my eyes had filled with blood. I fell several times but forced myself back up. I told myself I had to get home in case he came back to finish me off. I staggered around for another 100 yards. I was covered from head to waist in blood." End quote. Whilst Tracy survived the attack, she didn't escape unharmed and required brain surgery and spent over a week in hospital. Despite her brutal attack and injuries, Tracy still possessed the ability to provide the police with a clear description of the man who attacked her that night.
"He had dark afro-style hair, a really dark full beard, swarthy complexion, very dark eyes, almost black eyes."
The police drew up a photo fit based on the description, but despite this, a suspect was never identified in Tracy's attack. Marcella Claxton was attacked in the early hours of the 9th of May, 1976. The 20-year-old was walking home alone from a party in Roundhay Park in Leeds. Whilst Roundhay Park is one of the largest city parks in Europe, it's also one of the most popular parks in Leeds. It covers an impressive 700 acres of land that boasts beautiful rolling parkland, lakes, woodland and gardens, and has so many attractions, including a skate park, canoe club and land train. As she was walking, Sutcliffe offered Marcella a lift home. Surely it was much safer for her to accept the offer of a lift than attempt to traverse through the dark, lonely park by herself. If only she could have foreseen that in actuality, she was much safer taking her chances and walking through the park alone. Sutcliffe drove them to Soldiers Field and Marcella got out of the car to urinate behind some trees. I guess hindsight is a wonderful thing, and maybe if she'd have escaped while she had the chance, she wouldn't have had to endure a brutal attack. However, unfortunately, this isn't how things panned out, and instead, Sutcliffe followed Marcella out of the car and, as he had done several times before, struck her over the head with a hammer. Fortunately, Marcella survived the attack and was able to testify against Sutcliffe at his future trial. Marcella also described her attacker as being a white man with black hair and beard with a Yorkshire accent. In July 1977, 3 months before Jean Jordan's brutal murder, 42-year-old Maureen Long was viciously attacked by Sutcliffe. She'd spent the evening drinking in various pubs around Bradford and ended her night at a discotheque, which she left at about 2 a.m. Sutcliffe saw Maureen staggering home and offered her a lift. The pair ended up at Bowling Back Lane, and whilst Maureen was urinating, Sutcliffe hit her over the head and dragged her to some nearby wasteland. Sutcliffe then stabbed her before fleeing the scene at about 3:30 a.m. It wouldn't be until about 5 hours later, when two women heard Maureen's whimpering, that she would be discovered. Maureen provided police with a description of her attacker. However, her memory had clearly been affected by the attack, and her description didn't match other descriptions survivors have given. Maureen described her attacker as a white, 36 or 37-year-old man who was well-built and stood at about 6'1". He had puffy cheeks, thick eyebrows, and wiry blonde hair. Whilst this doesn't fit Sutcliffe, he did go on to confess that he'd committed the attack. In January 1978, police gave up searching for the owner of the £5 note from Jean Jordan's murder. As Sutcliffe had provided a credible alibi for his whereabouts the night Jean died, he was removed from the inquiry in January. Not long after he was eliminated from the investigation, Sutcliffe struck again. On the evening of the 21st of January 1978, 21-year-old Yvonne Pearson left her two young children in the care of a 16-year-old neighbour and went to a pub in Bradford. She left around 9:30 p.m. to find a punter and came across Sutcliffe in his car and offered her services as a sex worker. They drove to a piece of wasteland where Sutcliffe bludgeoned her repeatedly with a hammer before proceeding to jump on her chest. He then stuffed horsehair into her mouth from a discarded sofa before discarding Yvonne's body under the sofa near Lum Lane, a street which sex workers are known to frequent even to this day. On the 26th of March, Yvonne's lifeless body was discovered under the sofa by a passerby who was struck by the putrid smell of her rotting body. Helen Reitke was just 18 years old and working as a sex worker alongside her twin sister Rita in Huddersfield when she crossed paths with Peter Sutcliffe on the evening of the 31st of January 1978. Sutcliffe picked Helen up under the pretense of needing sexual favours, and as she climbed out of the passenger side to get into the back seat, Sutcliffe struck her over the head and she crumpled to the floor. He then dragged her to the end of the woodyard, as he realised there were two taxi drivers nearby who would have been able to see the assault. There, he raped Helen and waited until the taxi drivers left before retrieving his hammer from the car. Still alive, Helen got up and began to stagger to the car before he struck her over the head again and proceeded to stab her several times in the chest. It took Rita 3 days to report her twin sister missing due to the stigma surrounding sex work. At 3:10 on the 3rd of February, a police dog located Helen's body, discarded behind an unused garage under a sheet of asbestos. Helen was virtually naked, except for her polo neck jumper being pushed up to expose her breasts and her socks. Her exposed chest revealed the 3 stab wounds that had penetrated her heart and lungs. Sutcliffe's final murder of 1978 was committed on the 16th of May. 40-year-old mother of 7, Vera Millwood, was a frail woman of ill health. She had chronic stomach pain and only one lung. She left her home at 10 p.m. to peruse the streets of Manchester for a client. Sutcliffe picked her up and drove her 2.5 miles away to a car park behind Manchester Royal Infirmary, where prostitutes and their clients were known to frequent. As she was climbing out of the car, Sutcliffe struck her over the head with a hammer. Her body was found the following morning at 8 a.m. by some workers who had arrived to do some gardening on the grounds of the hospital. Vera had been brutally beaten. Blood and brain matter stained her clothes, and her intestines spilled out of wounds on her abdomen. These succession of attacks is when the media dubbed the vicious murderer as the Yorkshire Ripper. The investigation into the Yorkshire Ripper ramped up a gear, and police set up an undercover operation to take note of number plates of cars that frequented red light areas. Police were specifically looking for cars that were spotted in 2 or more districts. Through this operation, one name cropped up again and again, Peter Sutcliffe.
Sutcliffe had been sighted in the red light areas 3 times in Leeds, once in Manchester, and numerous times in Bradford, in excess of 70 sightings in Bradford.
Police interviewed Sutcliffe again, where he informed them that he was spotted in Bradford so much because he drove through on his way home from work. But police weren't convinced and planned to interview him again. That was until another girl fell victim to the Ripper. Josephine Whittaker was just 19 years old when she was murdered by Sutcliffe on the 4th of April 1979 as she was walking home from her grandparents' house through Savile Park Moor, a large open park area just outside of Halifax town centre. Police believed Sutcliffe switched his modus operandi up to avoid capture as he'd been spotted too much in the red light districts of Bradford. Sutcliffe was searching for his next victim when he saw Josephine walking alone. He followed her for a few minutes before finally catching up with her and striking up a conversation. Sutcliffe walked with Josephine, and as they were walking across a pitch black field, he struck her over the head with a hammer. He dragged her body 30 feet away from the nearby road and proceeded to stab her 21 times with a screwdriver in the chest and stomach, and a further 6 stab wounds were inflicted to her right leg. Before he left her for dead, he thrust the screwdriver into Josephine's vagina. Her brutalised body was discovered the following morning by a woman waiting at a bus stop on the other side of the road. Josephine's 13-year-old brother was crossing the park when he saw the hive of police activity and got close enough to the scene to recognise one of the shoes as belonging to his older sister. He ran home and informed his parents, who hurriedly phoned the police in a blind panic. Once again, the police had a boot print near Josephine's body, a finding that had seemed to become a regular occurrence. The print was analysed and revealed a worn-down part on the right impression, leading police to speculate that the owner of the boot may have been a long-distance driver. This clue also took the police straight back to Sutcliffe, who was a long-distance lorry driver for the haulage firm. However, the case suddenly took a left turn when police received a taped message claiming to be the killer and taunting the police for not being able to catch him. It was revealed years later that this tape was just a hoax, However, at the time, police had to investigate it seriously, and this subsequently cost more lives at the hands of Peter Sutcliffe. The tape was addressed to Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield and was received on the 19th of June, 1979. It stated, quote, "I'm Jack. I see you are still having no luck catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George, but Lord, you are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started. I reckon your boys are letting you down, George. They can't be much good, can they?" End quote. The FBI were able to determine fairly quickly that this was quite clearly a hoax. However, it still needed to be investigated to determine who had wasted police's time and removed the efforts that should have gone into identifying the Yorkshire Ripper. This wasn't the first time Jack had made himself known. In fact, an entire year earlier, in March 1978, the Daily Mirror and George Oldfield received some letters from him claiming to be their killer. Quote, "Dear Sir, I'm sorry I cannot give my name for obvious reasons. I am the Ripper. I've been dubbed a maniac by the press, but not by you. You call me clever, and I am. You and your mates haven't a clue. That photo in the paper gave me fits, and that bit about killing myself? No chance. I've got things to do. My purpose to rid the streets of them sluts. My one regret is that young lassie MacDonald. Up to number 8 now. You say 7, but remember Preston 75? Get about, you know. You were right, I travel a bit. You probably look for me in Sunderland. Don't bother, I'm not daft. Just posted letter there on one of my trips. Not a bad place compared with Chapel Town and Manningham and other places. Worn whores to keep off streets because I feel it coming on again. Sorry about young lassie. Yours respectfully, Jack the Ripper. Might write again later. I'm not sure last one really deserved it. Whores getting younger each time. Old slut next time, I hope. Huddersfield never again. Too small, close call last one." End quote. Preston 75 referred to the murder of Joan Harrison, which at the time was believed to have been perpetrated by the Yorkshire Ripper. However, Sutcliffe denied any involvement in this crime, and it was officially determined in 2011 that he wasn't Joan's killer, and it was in fact Christopher Smith, who had passed away in 2008 and had been charged with several other crimes, including attempted rape and manslaughter. Using forensic linguistics, the police and voice analysts were able to deduce that the hoaxer was from Castletown in Sunderland, which led to 40,000 people being investigated. Whilst this ultimately led police nowhere, as Sutcliffe was from Bradford and not Sunderland, police still remained hopeful that they would be able to identify the mystery Jack. A publicity campaign was started which cost over £1 million and included Dial the Ripper hotlines, billboards, adverts in 300 newspapers in an attempt to catch the creator of the tape recording. These efforts by police produced no new information or suspects, and instead they just wasted their time and resources, allowing Sutcliffe to continue killing. Voice analysts attempted to convince police that the letters on audio recording were a hoax, however they refused to believe it. Ultimately, they were forced to abandon the search for the hoaxer, as Sutcliffe's killings didn't cease. It wouldn't be until 2005 when senior officers from West Yorkshire's Homicide and Major Inquiry team opened up the inquiry again. They discovered DNA on one of the envelopes, and these were matched with John Humble, who had been arrested 4 years prior for being drunk and disorderly. John, who was a chronic alcoholic from Sunderland, was arrested on the 18th of October 2005 and charged with 4 counts of perverting the course of justice. He initially pled not guilty before finally accepting and admitting his guilt in March 2006. On the 21st of March, he was sentenced to 8 years in prison and was released just 3 years later in 2009. He was given a new identity as John Samuel Anderson and passed away at his home on the 30th of July 2019 at the age of 63 as a result of heart failure and side effects of his alcoholism. Whilst the Wearside Jack investigation was taking place, Sutcliffe struck again. 20-year-old Barbara Leach was studying social psychology at Bradford University when she was out drinking with friends on the evening of the 1st of September 1979. They left the pub in the early hours of the morning, and Barbara decided to separate from the group and walk alone. Sutcliffe was parked nearby and climbed out of the car as she walked past. Once she'd walked past the car, he hit her over the head with a hammer before dragging her into a nearby garden and proceeded to stab her with the same knife as he'd murdered Josephine Whittaker with. Barbara's body was found discarded at 3:55 p.m. later that day, just 200 yards from where she'd left her friends. As with several other of the murders, it appeared Sutcliffe had no motive to kill Barbara. The fact that she wasn't a sex worker made the public fearful, and in an attempt to solve these murders and remove the perpetrator from the streets, a publicity campaign was pushed, emphasising the link between the Yorkshire Ripper and the Wearside Jack. Whilst police were adamant that they were the same person, we now obviously know that they definitely weren't. Sutcliffe was interviewed at least twice in 1979 in relation to the murders, and nine times overall. However, he was never strongly considered as a likely suspect by police, which allowed him to continue killing innocent women. In April of 1980, Sutcliffe was arrested for drunk driving. However, even a close run-in with police wouldn't deter him from his heinous ways, and he committed two more murders whilst he was awaiting trial for driving under the influence. Marguerite Walls was 47 years old when she was murdered by Sutcliffe on the 20th of August, and Jacqueline Hill was a 20-year-old University of Leeds student when she was murdered on the 17th of November. Sutcliffe then committed a further and final three attacks. However, these women survived. Apadja Bandara was attacked on the 24th of September in Leeds. Maureen Lee was an art student who was attacked on the grounds of Leeds University on the 25th of October, and Teresa Sykes was just 16 years old when Sutcliffe attacked her in Huddersfield on the 5th of November. All five of these murders and attacks were committed late at night when it would have been pitch black and there would have been no one around to witness or interrupt the brutal attacks the girls endured. Peter Sutcliffe had attacked 22 people between 1969 and 1980, but finally, his attacks would end with Jacqueline Hill being his final victim on the 17th of November 1980. Sutcliffe was apprehended on the 2nd of January 1981, just months after he claimed his final life. That evening, police were doing routine checks of areas around Sheffield that were known to be frequented by sex workers. During one of these checks, police discovered Sutcliffe with 24-year-old sex worker Olivia Reavers. Probationary Constable Robert Hydes performed a police check which revealed the car Sutcliffe was driving had false number plates. Sutcliffe was subsequently arrested and transferred to Dewsbury Police Station in West Yorkshire, where he was questioned by the Ripper Squad about the Yorkshire Ripper case because he bore several physical characteristics witnesses had described to police. This was the 10th time Sutcliffe had been interviewed in relation to the case, and they were determined to either prove or refute the suspicions that he was the Yorkshire Ripper once and for all. On the 3rd of January, the day after he was arrested, police returned to the scene where Sutcliffe had been arrested just hours earlier in a desperate attempt to find any evidence against him. There, the policeman who arrested Sutcliffe discovered a knife, hammer, and rope that Sutcliffe had been able to discard when he was being arrested after disappearing out of his sight for just a few seconds. He was then able to discard a second knife he had in his possession into a toilet cistern at the police station. As a result of these finds and Sutcliffe matching the description given to police by witnesses, police obtained a search warrant for his home address and began questioning his wife. Sutcliffe was stripped down at the police station, which revealed he was wearing a V-neck sweater under his trousers. Sutcliffe's legs were placed through the arms of the sweater and the V-neck exposed his genitals, proving that the majority of his attacks were sexually motivated. It would later be revealed that Sutcliffe would masturbate over the bodies of his victims. The elbows of the sweater were padded, presumably to protect his knees as he knelt over his victims' bodies. Suddenly, on the 4th of January 1981, after 2 days of questioning, Sutcliffe readily confessed to police that he was the Yorkshire Ripper, a revelation which the police were elated by, but also frustrated over, as he'd escaped their clutches numerous times before. Retired detective Andrew Laptew remembers learning about the confession.
When I first heard that Peter Sutcliffe was a Yorkshire Ripper, it's very difficult to describe how I actually felt, but it was like being punched in the heart, to be honest. The fact that I had interviewed Sutcliffe and that he had gone on to kill and injure other victims was something that is going to live with me and stay with me to my grave.
Sutcliffe spent the following day calmly revealing all the details of his crimes to the police interviewing him. He showed no emotion when detailing his crimes, except for when he discussed the murder of his youngest victim, Jane MacDonald. Weeks after his confession, Sutcliffe contended that he had committed the murders at God's instruction. On the 5th of January 1981, Sutcliffe was charged with 13 counts of murder, to which he pled not guilty, but he did plead guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. The diminished responsibility defence was based on the fact that he insisted he heard voices that ordered him to murder the sex workers, and that the voices began when he was working as a gravedigger. Sutcliffe contended that the voices he heard were those of God. Whilst he denied murder, he did plead guilty to 7 counts of attempted murder. The prosecution intended to accept Sutcliffe's plea when 4 psychiatrists diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia. However, the trial judge took an unusual decision and overruled the prosecution, demanding a detailed explanation as to why the prosecution wished to accept this plea. Justice Sir Leslie Boreham overruled the prosecution's decision to accept the plea and insisted the case go to trial. The trial commenced on the 29th of April 1981 at the Old Bailey and lasted 2 weeks before the jury found him guilty of murder on all counts. The jury rejected the psychiatrist's evidence regarding Sutcliffe's paranoid schizophrenia, and he was ultimately sentenced to 20 concurrent life sentences. The judge concluded that Sutcliffe was beyond redemption and should never be released from prison before recommending he serve at least 30 years in prison before being considered for parole. On the 16th of July 2010, Sutcliffe became one of the few prisoners who were issued a whole life tariff, which was introduced by the government in 1983. This means that Sutcliffe is highly likely to never be released and will more than likely die in prison. At trial, Sutcliffe was deemed sane despite a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia, which saw all attempts at him being sent to a secure psychiatric hospital fail, meaning he began his incarceration at HMP Parkhurst on the Isle of Wight on the 22nd of May 1981. On the 10th of January 1983, Sutcliffe was attacked by 35-year-old career criminal James Costello, who plunged a broken coffee jar twice into the side of his face in the hospital wing of HMP Parkhurst. The attack caused 4 wounds to Sutcliffe's face, which required 30 stitches to repair. Sutcliffe's incarceration at Parkhurst was short-lived, and in March 1984, he was sent to Broadmoor Hospital under Section 47 of the 1983 Mental Health Act. In 1982, Sutcliffe's wife ceased their relationship and then requested a divorce in April 1994. Sutcliffe's attack at HMP Parkhurst wasn't the only attack he suffered whilst incarcerated, and some would say this was Sutcliffe getting a taste of his own medicine. Karma can work in wonderful ways. On the 23rd of February 1996, he was attacked in his room at Broadmoor Hospital by convicted robber Paul Wilson, who asked to borrow a videotape from Sutcliffe before strangling him with the wire of some headphones. 2 convicted murderers overheard Sutcliffe's screams and intervened and stopped the attack in its tracks. On the 10th of March 1997, Sutcliffe was attacked by fellow inmate Ian Kay with a pen, which caused loss of vision in his left eye and resulted in his right eye being severely damaged. The attacks didn't stop there, though. Fellow inmate Patrick Sarida lunged at Sutcliffe with a knife on the 22nd of December 2007, whilst shouting, quote, "You fucking raping, murdering bastard, I'll blind your fucking other one," end quote. The knife narrowly missed Sutcliffe's right eye and instead struck him in the cheek. Sutcliffe was reported to have been fit to leave Broadmoor on the 17th of February 2009, and on the 23rd of March 2010, the Secretary of State for Justice, Jack Straw, was questioned by MPs and asked for reassurance for one of Sutcliffe's surviving victims that he would remain in prison. Jack Straw informed the questioning MPs that whilst this was a matter for the parole board to decide, quote, "that all the evidence that I have seen on this case, and it's a great deal, suggests to me that there are no circumstances in which this man will be released," end quote. With whole life orders, a minimum term is usually set, and in July 2010, Sutcliffe requested for this to be done. This appeal was heard by the High Court of Justice on the 16th of July, where it was determined that Sutcliffe would never be released from prison, with Mr. Justice Mitting stating, quote, "This was a campaign of murder which terrorised the population of a large part of Yorkshire for several years. The only explanation for it, on the jury's verdict, was anger, hatred and obsession. Apart from a terrorist outrage, it's difficult to conceive of circumstances in which one man could account for so many victims," end quote. On the 4th of August 2010, Sutcliffe appealed the decision that he would remain incarcerated until his death, with the hearing taking place on the 30th of November 2010. The Court of Appeal rejected this appeal on the 14th of January 2011. In December 2015, Sutcliffe was deemed as not mentally ill anymore, and in August 2016, it was ruled by a medical tribunal that Sutcliffe no longer required clinical psychiatric care and was able to return to prison. It's reported that he was transferred from Broadmoor to Franklin Prison in Durham not long after this judgment was made. The Yorkshire Ripper is behind bars, but not before he had the opportunity to rip multiple families apart and claim the lives of 13 entirely innocent women, mothers, daughters, aunts. 26-year-old mother of four, Wilma McCann. 42-year-old Emily Jackson. 28-year-old mother of three, Irene Richardson. 32-year-old Patricia Atkinson. 16-year-old Jane McDonald. 20-year-old mother of two, Jean Jordan. 21-year-old Yvonne Pearson. 18-year-old Helen Reitker. 40-year-old mother of seven, Vera Millwood. 19-year-old Josephine Whittaker. 20-year-old Barbara Leach. 47-year-old Marguerite Walls. And 20-year-old Jacqueline Hill. They're the names we should be remembering, not the name of Peter Sutcliffe. They are the women whose lives were snatched from them in the most heinous and brutal way. We can't also forget Sutcliffe survivors, women whose lives were forever maimed and tarnished as a result of their brutal attack. 36-year-old Anna Rogalski, who eventually passed away in 2008. 46-year-old Olive Smelt, who passed away in 2011. 14-year-old Tracy Brown. 20-year-old Marcella Claxton. 25-year-old Marilyn Moore, Singapore-born 34-year-old Dr. Apadja Bandara, Maureen Lee, 16-year-old Teresa Sykes. Eight women who are known as survivors of the Yorkshire Ripper, but their legacy should be of strength, courage and bravery. Whilst the general public are safe from Sutcliffe's heinous acts, the pain and hurt he inflicted on his victims and victims' family is a burden they will carry with them until their final breath. For the public, the nightmare ended when Sutcliffe was finally apprehended and charged. However, for the surviving victims and the families of the women who didn't survive the attack, the nightmare is one that will never cease.
Why did he do it to me? What was going through his head? How did he feel? Does he feel any remorse about what he's done? Not only to me, but about all these other people as well? Or is it just nothing inside? there. He's just totally bad and evil.
I've seen how it's affected my family and my siblings and my older sister Sonia especially. She felt that she didn't deserve to live to be older than my mum. At 28, mum died. And when Sonia became 28, it's almost like she got even worse because she didn't feel like she deserved to live. And very sadly, to say the least, Sonia took her life in December, just gone, last Christmas. And, you know, I put that down to what he did, Peter Sutcliffe, on the night mum died.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and review, and Patreon to consider becoming a patron of Murder & More. To interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at Murder & More, Instagram at Murder & More Pod, and Facebook at Murder & More Podcast. To view the sources and pictures for this episode, head over to www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.
From the brilliant creative minds that brought you Keep Drinking, It'll Get Better, and The Real Housewives of Hillcrest Nursing Home comes the podcast that people are raving about. Hi, this is Edward October for OctoberPodVHS.com, here to tell you what people are saying about our true crime podcast. A thread store in Arizona says, too much dribble and slang. These ladies obviously enjoy their own humor and sound high. Hey, at least they called you ladies. Benny from Idaho says, your topics are so appealing, but a three-person pod is difficult enough to follow without banter? Our true crime podcast only has two people? Wait. Where's the other 100 five-star reviews? Can somebody give me the five-star reviews? Okay, here we go. Much better. Luscious Lee says, stand up. 5 stars. You girls are funny AF. I especially love the Me and Mrs. Jones rendition you sneak into the recording. Cherry G 107 says, I struggle finding a new podcast, and so far, I've been hooked to you guys' podcasts. Keep up the good work. Thumbs up, smiley face. Our true crime podcast, 2 girls, 1 story, and lots of bad renditions of songs you love. Available on your favorite podcatcher. Go binge it today.